Thanks so much, Minister. Thanks for your kind words and for launching our book today. Now, we're going to do something slightly different now. We're going to, rather than have everyone involved in the panel speak individually, what I'm going to do is just do a bit of a Q&A. And I must apologise for some false advertising. We originally advertised that our patron, Julie McCrossan, would be running the Q&A today for us and hosting the event. But unfortunately, Julie's had a quite serious health scare, which has meant that she hasn't been able to join us today. So she passes on her best regards to us, and she's certainly in our thoughts today, but unfortunately couldn't be here. So you'll have to be very generous and pretend that I am Julie McCrossan and try and hold me to a slightly lower standard. So what I'm going to do is just going to ask some of the people who are involved in the book and involved in some of the stories some questions. So I'll properly introduce the panel. So Gary Traynor is the CEO of Sydney Community College, and his organisation provided the course, the Women's Micro Business course, that Sahar took part in, that features in the book. Professor Barry Golding is the president of Adult Learning Australia, amongst other things. He's also the patron of the Australian Men's Sheds Association, and in his spare time he works as a professor of education at the University of Ballarat. They think that's his main job, but we haven't told them that this is actually his main job, and that's what he does in his spare time. So Mick Goss features in the book. Mick is a Taswegian, and it's his first time in Sydney, and he's managed to get away from the beautiful country around Launceston and come into this smoggy, busy, dirty city. Big sacrifice for the first time ever, so big sacrifice on his part to be here. Sahar Elsbury, of course, is featured in the book. She's one of the learners who went through the Women's Micro Business course, and of course the minister we've just heard from. So I'll just pick up the microphone, and I'm just going to ask people some questions. And if there's some questions from the floor that people want to ask one of our panel members as well, I'll give you an opportunity in a moment. Stand over here and pick up the roving mic. So I might start with you, Mick. You knew I would, didn't you? So, Mick, the course that you talked about in the book is a dad's course. So it was just for dads. And the title of the book was that dads learn differently. So can you tell us where that expression, dads learn differently, came from and what it might mean?
That came from we had a lady from the dietitian that came along, Sandy Murray, and she did a dads in the kitchen course for us. And she came in with those two nice big folders. She's been running courses all around Launceston and Tasmania and that, mainly for mums, and this was the first time she did one for the dads. And when she came in, we set up and everything, and she started going through this book and section by section and telling us all about it. And about halfway through the introduction of the book and the folders that was given, at first she went out the window. And she said, why? We want to learn different. Mm. And us blokes, we're more hands-on. But we did the same thing, what she had in the book, but we did more hands-on. And it was great. And it ended up being first time her dad's did a course like that through the dietitian. But it was sort of 10 weeks of, and the dads thoroughly enjoyed it.
Fantastic, Mick. Yeah. That's a great story. Now, I'll bring you in here, Barry, because Barry is somewhat of an expert in men's learning. So I'm just wondering, this was Mick's experience. Is Mick's experience common? Do dads or men learn differently, do you think?
I think in the past there was more... A lot of people in older generations, including my generation and Mick, went to school at times when things were much different, mm. and the way things were taught, and there was a lot of put downs. Mm. There was a lot of violence for a lot of people in schools. Even my wife remembers in the school she was in, violence being used in ways that I was pretty surprised about. So I guess what I'm saying is, people who were good with education 30, 40, 50 years ago coped. Mm. It's those that didn't cope with that, and who, I think Mick was telling me beforehand, some of the experiences you had where they put you in a room And they did a spelling test, and because you only got grade 3 when you're in grade 5, they really made you feel like you were an idiot. And that really damages people for life. And so I would say some women would also experience that. But since my particular interest is with men, a lot of men found they could go to work and get over that formal learning stuff. But later in life, when you need to use a website or when you need to help your grandkids or work with your children, you're often in great distress because you can't even get to basics and your kids are actually doing stuff you can't do. And I think Sharon made that point. It's really important to acknowledge that while schools can and do make a difference, the biggest difference that you can actually make is actually ensuring you've got well-educated parents.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, bang for your buck. If you get a good parent program going, I don't know how you do it, that would probably be good value. So I've probably drifted around it.
No, that's great, Barry. I might bring Sahar in here now. Now, Sahar, your background was quite different because you had quite a good education in your first country, but then found yourself, you were university educated in your first country and then arrived here as a migrant and had to start again to a certain extent. Tell us a little bit about how that was for you and some of the challenges you experienced.
I'm originally from Egypt. I almost finished my master's degree in English literature, but because the subject at that time I was doing my work in, it was about Darwin, and I wasn't that great fan of him. And that's why I didn't finish it. And then I met my husband and came here to Australia. When I first came here to Australia in 97, I was really like, I have nothing, all I can hear about Australians, it's just they are just famous for their sheep. And the thing is, like, I hear that they don't have any sense of humor, and they are really tough kind of people. Mm. It's just, it was a big step for me. And when I came first here, you can't imagine, I've taken every course in outreach. Took a course in medical terminology, one in floristry, one in gardening. I have done everything that is available for me while I'm raising my kids. Mm-hmm. I have 4 kids, and while I'm staying home, I prefer to stay at home and look after them, not work and so on. But the thing is, like, I wasn't happy with just looking after them because I needed to do more and be part of Australia. Because now I face the thing that I'm living now in Australia and this is my kids' country. It has to be mine as well. I have to be part of it and I have to learn everything. I don't want to feel like not knowing what is going on with my daughter when she starts talking about certain subjects or anything. Yes, sometimes I struggle with math.
We all do.
Yeah. I translate math in Arabic first and get it in English later on. The thing is, like, I'm still learning, and I would like always to be one step ahead of my kids, mm-hmm. because they are very scary and smart. And the thing is, you have to be one step ahead of them. You have to set an example for them. That is not mm-hmm. easy. You can't sit at home and receive help from the government. Mm-hmm. It is as if the government is raising them, not me. Mm-hmm. And my husband, the poor guy, is just looking after all of us. So the thing is, like, I want to take this step, and I didn't know how to take it, how to go out and start looking for work and so on.
Fantastic. Thank you, Sahar. I might bring Gary in here because Gary, as the CEO of Sydney Community College, organised this program. And what struck me when I read about this program was that it had all of the ingredients. It had a group of women that had very specific needs and very specific interests. It was a comprehensive program. It was flexible. Sahar talks in the book about how people laughed all the time and how the teacher managed to make it a really enjoyable program and a really wonderful place for people to be. There was childcare involved. Now, as someone who's administered programs before, I know that it's diabolically difficult to get the resources, all of the different resources, to put a comprehensive program like that together. Can you tell us a bit about how you managed to do that?
First of all, Sally, thank you for saying that I organised the course, which is entirely untrue. I had absolutely nothing to do with the organisation of the course. We wrote the submission to government. This is one of the great examples. This course is one of the great examples where government supplies money to do good work and through organisations like us. It's a small amount of money. In total, we spent about $80,000 on this project, which worked out to be about $2,000 per qualification, which is very, very, very small. Could I acknowledge the fact that Sahar's family are here today, and they are as much of the support of this program as anyone else? When I was fortunate enough to go along to the graduation of this particular project, Tonya Cook-Peterson, who is here with us today, who did organise the program, and Joanna Maxwell, he who was the main trainer in the program, along with a range of mentors, which are the embedded strength of these programs. Can also celebrate the fact that we have another graduate participant from the program here, Colleen, who was at that project. We are now in the second iteration of what's called the Certificate 3 in Micro Business for women. It's a very specialised program. It concentrates on women who may be determined as being slightly marginalised within the community. And it takes its strength, its great strength, from the very brave steps that many women actually do take to come along and do these and participate in these programs. What we certainly found, the anecdotal evidence that I got from Tonya and Joanna, is that once in the program, these women really shine. It's been a fabulous experience for us. And it's a great credit to the New South Wales State Government through their social inclusion programs that they continue to fund it.
Fabulous. Thanks, Gary. I might bring Sharon in here. So, Sharon, Gary's described this as a really effective program that costs quite a small amount of money. And a public servant once said to me when I was speaking passionately about very effective programs that cost small amounts of money, Sally, you've got to realise that for every dollar on the table, there are 10 grasping hands. It really does feel like that when you're in government. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the challenge of identifying these really wonderful, effective programs and seeing through the mountain of other sort of needs that are there and how policymakers can actually find out about these programs and build on them.
You've touched exactly on what is the great challenge, and even more so if you're out and about in the community and you see so many organisations doing so much great work and everybody basically running on the smell of an oily rag. There's a bit of me, because, you know, I've worked in education for most of my life and in juvenile justice. I work with a lot of community organisations that were working in the field, and it's a little bit of me that sometimes thinks the more money we put into things, the more they become remote from what you're trying to achieve. And I know that sounds a bit perhaps worrying to people, but there's something very powerful about very community connected organisations is what I think it actually is about. And that the more we can be vigilant that whatever processes we put in place, and the more money you've got, I think the more accountable you have to be. So it does, there's a layer of bureaucracy comes with that. And we need to be alert to the fact that happens, that we don't lose connection with people so that they still feel it's a place and a program they want to participate in. And so it is the case that, you know, I mean, you've only got to look at the conversation happening around the Gonski reforms for school funding, that you know, they're talking billions and billions of dollars that can be better targeted to what we want to achieve as a community. But at the same time, keep your eye on, and that's why I really enjoy doing events like this, is just to come and keep your eye on what makes a difference for people in communities. and you balance it up by getting whatever money you can from Treasury and making sure that you fund as much as you can. That's what we do. And understand that there will be people who are disappointed, but you've got to keep trying to keep that focus. It's a great outcome, I always think, when people sit around and talk about how something's changed their life. And so it is important that part of that accountability is actually things like this book, to be honest with you, so that stories are told and that at the end of the day we are elected, our democratic system's on the basis that people are telling us what they want us to do at election times and where the priorities should be. And if communities are reflecting that this is important to them, and many communities I think do, we all, if we love this stuff, have a responsibility about talking about it to keep it as a priority in a democratic process.
Fantastic. Thanks, Minister. Sahara, I might return to you now. You talked a little bit before about, and you talked to Ilka in the making of the book about what a terrific program this was. Now, you just mentioned before you'd done a lot of different courses. So if you reflect on all of those courses, what do you think are the features of a really good adult education program? What makes a really terrific one, do you think?
The one I did last year was microbusiness. The first thing that I asked Joanna at that time, if she remembered, I said, listen, I'm going to be 45 years old. Don't you think I'm too old for that? I'm starting, and it is just like, I wish I was 20 or before that, but I'm 45. I'm thinking about retiring, not like starting. And the thing is, she said, no, that's the thing now. That is the step, and you are ready for it. And every time, I remember I kept nagging her. Are you sure that I'm doing the thing, right thing? Are you sure? She built our confidence back into us. And the thing is, I wouldn't have found the same thing like I was doing with the outreach courses, like I did with the Sydney Community College, because that's more, I call it more personal.
More personal.
It is. It is more to me. It is not just because, like I'm telling you, I'm 46 this year, and I feel much younger. I feel really like, I told her at the end of the year, I feel more daring, as if I need more. I feel more daring. Even the color that I'm picking from my clothes is different. It is more colorful and more, it is not just in the books that we found what she taught us. It is the attitude, the changing of lifestyle, everything. It's more like, yes, you are, but just go.
That's lovely. Well, look, I might bring Joanna into the conversation. So what a wonderful job you have, Joanna. Can you tell us a little bit about this magical mix for bringing people out of themselves and learning wonderful skills?
I don't think I know what it was. All I know is this was my first... I had taught journalism, in fact, at Sydney Community College at night for years while I ran a corporate career. And I loved it, but it was only really when I found the program last year that I actually came home myself to what I love doing. And it was probably the greatest working privilege of my life to be involved with these women and to get the chance to do it all again this year. It is because you don't actually have to do anything, you just have to put a whole heap of women in the room and, you know, let them talk. And it was a co-creating. I'm doing a Masters of Education, and this is my case study for my first module. And really, that's the conclusion I came to, was that in the best of adult education, you co-create a learning. Yes, I provide certain small business knowledge, but they created their own program, and that's really, I think, where it happened.
Fantastic. Look, that reminded me a little bit of one of the stories that you told, Mick, in the book. You mentioned that after you were running the dad's group for a little while and you'd engaged on this learning journey yourself, that you saw a dad coming to the group who was sitting apart from everybody else and didn't seem to want to join in. Can you tell everyone that story? And
what I work out of the Ramswood Neighbour House in part of Launceston there. It's in the social inclusion area. Outside is a nice great big park area and everything, and kids to play and everything, and barbecue area and tables and chairs. Mm-hmm. And this particular day, I noticed his dad was sitting out there on the bench seat watching his child play, and I went out and introduced myself to him and everything, and started telling him about the dad's group. I don't know, why don't you come along and join us? And he was a bit hesitant to start with, and then said, hang on, we'll go and get a cup of coffee. And so I went and got him a cup of coffee and came back out and chatting a bit more, and brought out a couple of new brochures and the information on it and everything like that. And he was looking at it, and all of a sudden he turned around and said, I can't read. Mm. All right. And he was 35, around about the age of 35. And I said, don't worry about it, mate, because I can't either. don't know. Sort of, but that's what we're here for. Mm. We can help each other. And sort of, so he started coming on to the group, and it was one of the best things that happened to him. And I had to sort of, he just engaged, but he was very hesitant. Every time a teacher came along or an information person came along for a bit of information day, they'll give you a heap of paperwork to go with it, and all of a sudden, bam, he threw it away and stormed out. And sort of, because he was struggling. Mm-hmm. And that, but we had to break the barrier down slowly. Mm-hmm. Because he was very hesitant, and he had a lot of anger built up inside him and everything like that. And slowly we broke the barriers down, and I said, look, you don't have to write it down. You can just say it by verbally. And that was one of the big things that sort of came out of that. Some people can't put it down on paper, and I'm one of them. Mm. And sort of, but verbally, they can answer every question. Mm. So it was a chance that it could be still ticked off to say they'd done the course and everything, because he was able to answer the question verbally. And from that, he's now gone on to, he can do better than me in computers, and he's starting to go along to literacy programs and everything like that, and he's really going really well. But he said one thing to me here last week. His boy's now in grade 8 at high school, and because he struggled all his life himself, he's struggling with his child, and his child was struggling through school. Mm-hmm. And his boy's now in grade 8 at school, and he's finding it really hard for his child to go to school, because he's getting picked on because his literacy and reading skills are very low. I don't know how we can address that, but I think it needs a bit more looking into that side of it. And he's starting to really worry about his son now. Mm-hmm. He can help him so much, but he still needs a lot more help.
So. Well, I might bring Sharon in here, because intergenerational and family literacy, I know you and I have had this conversation. It's a passion of mine, and I know it's a passion of yours. Most OECD countries have intergenerational literacy programs, so programs where parents develop their reading and writing so that they can then assist their children with their reading and writing. And Australia's been a little bit slow off the mark with family literacy. There are a few examples around the place, but we don't seem to have it in the systemic way that countries like New Zealand or Canada or other countries have. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it hasn't really taken off in this country?
Yeah, it is a really interesting facet, I think. Look, first of all, I think part of the point is that the learning experience, if it's been negative, it's not even just straight about literacy. People can become reasonably literate through their school years but still have such a negative experience that even the attitudes and culture of learning can be an intergenerational problem. And it is exactly why, when you might remember initially Julia Gillard, the Education Minister, was talking about the fact we actually have a fantastic education system in this country, but we hadn't come to terms properly with what is she described that tale of disadvantage. And that's exactly where those intergenerational problems sit, and part of why we've been driving this agenda more broadly. And part of that is about giving that additional literacy money into the school system so they can do the programs that best suit. And some of that will be about bringing families in. I met some people from a council out in Western New South Wales, and the council had actually done a program. They had canteens all around town for sports facilities and things like that, and they needed canteen workers. But because of all the new hygiene requirements, there actually was a training component there I had to go along with being the canteen worker. And so they'd done something fantastic with the local TAFE and got together and said, look, there's a lot of Indigenous mums who are unemployed. Why don't we do a canteen workers program? And we'll put the literacy in with it as well. And we'll do it in the school. So they actually went along to do the course and attended school. And the impact on their kids' school attendance and attitudes at school just completely turned around. And so I think there are, as you say, some really great stories. I'm a bit of an advocate, but for you provide funding and let schools and communities find the best processes that work for them. Mm. I'm just very conscious that issues are different in all different communities. Mm. But there is no doubt that in engaging parents in whatever the format is, in learning and participating, makes such a significant difference. Mm. As much as they get older, about year eight and that, they start saying, well, you nick off, don't turn up at the school, drop me at the corner, all that sort of stuff, to persevere, the message you give about your interest and like that dad you're talking about is just as powerful too. So.
Fantastic. Oh, look, I might bring you in here, Barry, because I was really interested before when everyone was talking about the peer support element. So Joanne described it as just get a group of women in the room and they'll look after themselves, which I think is just wonderful advice for all teachers, get a group of adults in the room. Now, you hear lots and lots of stories as a researcher, so you hear these type of stories on a very broad level in all different parts of Australia. Is that a bit of a theme? Is that a key to a good adult learning program, that adult learners really need to assist each other and support each other as peers?
Yes, I think the research shows that in the end, the best, although some individuals can learn online individually, and that's the way some institutions are going, people who benefit most from learning are people who typically learn best collaboratively mm-hmm. with other people in informal settings. And the research shows that the best way to approach learning is, ironically, to not actually foreground learning. Because mm-hmm. if someone like Mick was to come a few years ago, before you develop your confidence, if someone says, do you want to come and do some education, mm-hmm. Mick would say no. Mm-hmm. And in some senses, education itself can actually be the barrier. There's the last quote in the book, and I'm only using it because I wrote it, and it's actually about men, but if you take men out of it, the best forms of education don't necessarily treat adults from what I call a deficit model. We start from what people know and can do rather than from what people can't do. And so, in a sense, it's building what they do. And the idea of, and one of my problems with some of the models we have of providing learning and other services in the community is we tend to treat people as students and customers and clients and in the health system as patients. And that can be patronising. Mm-hmm. And there's a term that comes out of sociology called agency. And we know that Mick and Sahar have succeeded because they became agents in their own change. So you were empowered to actually transform yourselves while your teachers played a part. In the end, you can't actually create a transformative situation unless the person themselves is part of the transformation and actually contributes the energy to it. So I love the theory of agency, and I think, in summary, the best adult education is where we can generate agency. We do that through MenSheds, we do that through adult and community education, we do it through migrant education, but it's not top-down, it's bottom-up. And I agree with Sharon that some of the best forms of education aren't necessarily the ones that are fully funded, because that actually reduces agency, because that is done to people rather than being done by people and communities.
Thank you. Look, I'm really loving this conversation, but Ilka's giving me hand signals to suggest that people might love a cup of tea and some of the lovely refreshments even more. So we might bring our panel to a close on that point. Saha and her colleagues in the microbusiness program have put on a beautiful morning tea for us. So please stay and have a cup of tea and take part in some of the informal learning we have this morning. But before we do that, can you please thank our panel, our new minister, Saha, Mick, Barry and Gary.